everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. All right. Welcome back, everyone. It is Brandon Odo back here with Brian Bowling.
Hey, everybody.
And we have returning guest Nick Gioni here with us. He's a Pulm Crit attending over at the MedStar Baltimore system. He's been on before, and he actually wanted to come and kind of nudge us, host us through a bit of a discussion on a topic that's been of interest to him, and is it of interest to me? I guess I don't know if it interests Brian, but that's too.
I think this is really.
It's about cognitive biases and the kind of systematic ways that we tend to have a hard time making rational. Well-reasoned decisions, I guess, in life, but it comes up a lot in medicine. This is a topic that is, I think, relevant to anyone who cares about how and why and how effectively we make decisions in medicine, which is obviously the main activity that we participate in medicine. But if you've been around for more than 5 minutes on this planet, you've probably realized that people are often not very good at making decisions. And a lot of the ways that we do it wrong are not just a you thing or a me thing, but kind of more of a systematic thing, maybe a flaw in how human beings work. So Nick's going to give us a little bit of insight into this topic. I think it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. I think this is something. So when I teach my NP students, they have a whole class on diagnostic reasoning and clinical decision making, and we spend a whole like half class on this idea of heuristics versus. The stepwise approach and how it can speed up your decision-making, but all sorts of biases and stuff. So I'm interested to get your take on it and then maybe just use this instead of teaching class. So I'll just hit play and sit back.
Right. No pressure at all. to start as a disclaimer, I am by no means an expert in heuristics and or cognitive biases. I always have to look them up. I always have to have like a list, like what is, is this... Is this sunken cost bias? Like, what is this bias that we're sort of fitting in? Where this sort of started for me was I was thinking about doing some episode or some content on like rapid responses because, and I think then the good thing about this podcast and I've had, people from like sort of nurses, NPs, PAs, residents, not really attendings because I don't know how much attendings listen to podcasts, but have all come up to me and have heard like our episodes before. So it reaches like a wide audience. And the reason that's important is because specifically in the rapid response, depending on where you are, I think differs on who runs the rapid response. So when I was a resident, we were in a small community hospital. So the residents ran the rapid responses. When I was a fellow, it was a larger academic teaching quaternary center. And they had all separate rapid response team that had like a hospitalist on it, but also had critical care RNs that would, run it and be a part of the team. And then where I am now, nurses are running rapid responses. And then, some other hospitals probably have APPs in some way run rapid responses. And the rapid response is probably like the best scenario you can think of where this idea of heuristics and cognitive bias come into play, number one. Number two is it's the best example I can think of that really highlights where these things are coming from, which is like this sort of systems-based thinking approach, which, is from the book Thinking Fast and Slow, which I think came out in 2011. It's recommended, I think, for, a lot of people to read, not only in medicine, but other forms of like business and psychology and kind of thing.
Daniel Kahneman.
Right? Daniel Kahneman, yes.
Yeah, I just started reading
Daniel
it,
Kahneman. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. And not to sort of spoil it, I think it's a good book. Don't get me wrong. It's like sort of a seminal work. He tries to break the way we think down into sort of like a simplistic view and which I guess is fine and sort of comes up with these two systems-based thinking approaches. So like system one, system two. So system one is sort of like the fast, automatic, frequent, unconscious thought process that a person will make decisions under that paradigm. And, you know, sort of, let's say if we're thinking about medicine, maybe emergency medicine sort of comes into your mind, because they're sort of just, you know, like see a pattern, shoot from the hip, and just sort of like make a decision. And that I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I say that, because I think a lot of them will sort of agree with that statement. System two is a little bit more deliberate, slow, and conscious. And it's sort of a battle of these systems where heuristics and bias come into play, because how do we sort of, you know, interpret all of the data that we're getting input from the world around us? And if we were to think about each piece of data sort of in its own and sort of along those lines, it would take a long time to make a decision. So to sort of hack that, we create heuristics. So we sort of see a pattern and then make a decision based off that pattern. And because of that is where we introduce bias. Now for medicine, that's, I never found it very helpful to think about like what bias am I displaying? Because if I can identify I'm displaying some specific bias, let's say it's like anchoring. I think anchoring comes up a lot in, you know, clinical medicine, like you're anchoring on a diagnosis. You're sort of just identifying the problem. Like what's the solution to that? Like how do you not anchor, I suppose, would be, is like a better question. So have a broad differential, think about a lot of different reasons, or, you know, like what combats cognitive bias, I guess is really what is probably the most important part, because cognitive bias, let's say anchoring, can get you into hot water with specific scenarios, especially if you anchor on the wrong diagnosis and maybe it's incorrect, the patient gets the wrong treatment and then has a bad outcome. So getting back to the rapid response issue, like you sort of almost have to be system one in that, you know, maybe a rapid response or a code blue, right? You don't really think about each decision in of itself, like, should I give the epi? Should I not give the epi? Should we do CPR? Should we not do CPR? Like it just sort of falls into this pattern and you go with that pattern that's set up by your heuristics about that specific situation. Now, personally, for me as a critical care doc, the reason why I like that is because I get to sort of exercise both systems, system one and system two. So if I am in a situation where I have sort of a pattern set up in my mind and I identify that pattern. And this was actually, you know, this, like that sort of pattern recognition is a whole different technique, which you guys may or may not have heard of, is like shadow boxing technique, that I know that on like MCRIT, Scott does a lot of like sessions or like sort of episodes with shadow boxing. So you sort of ask experts how they would approach different situations. And that's actually born out of a study, I believe, done by Klein and Heinz. I hope I'm saying that right. On how you can impart expertise into novices without having that novice spend X amount of time in that specific craft. So I think what they did was they took in that scenario, and this is, you know, a little bit off topic, but has, I think, is going to circle back. They took firefighters that were experienced and gave them specific situations and asked them what they would do in that situation. And what they found is that there's, you know, like thousands of variables that can occur, but what the firefighter is seeing is just a pattern that they might have experienced before. And then they're fitting that sort of situation into some pattern recognition and then going based off of previous experience about that pattern that they saw. So shadow boxing and sort of pattern recognition is how like the most highly trained individuals tackle complex issues. It's not by like breaking it down like problem by problem or data point by data point, because that would take too long. And especially when you're in a time, sort of a time crunch with a fire or, you know, a code blue, you can't sit there and sort of, you know, dwell on every specific data point. So you fit these things into pattern recognition. Is it enough to sort of sit there and say, okay, Nick's not going to anchor on, you know, that the patient who has heart failure, you know, actually has pneumonia? Because I think, you know, the eternal question when someone comes in with shortness of breath and sort of an x-ray that could be either is, which one is it? And then we sort of start to use different data points to anchor on specific diagnoses, right? Like, oh, the BNP is 4,000 and the white count is 12. So it's probably pneumonia. It's probably not pneumonia. So, but, you know, just identifying the bias doesn't exactly protect us from that specific decision in that time. So as I research more about sort of the system one, system two thinking. And this isn't really like sort of a deep dive into all the different cognitive biases, which I think of which there's like hundreds. And they're very interesting. Don't get me wrong, how many different cognitive biases are identified. But what can we do as clinicians to guard ourselves from cognitive bias? Because that cognitive bias, while is built from our heuristic model, which we need to sort of operate in this world, especially with, you know, high stakes, fast moving, a lot of data. How do we guard ourselves from making mistakes? Because when we make mistakes, it could cost a life. So, sort of a long intro into two specific ways that, you know, the business world deals with cognitive bias, which a lot of what I found today is sort of born out of business. So like finance managers, or if we're starting a new company, or like sort of identifying or having a project, then identifying potential problems. And so what I found was sort of two strategies, and maybe, you know, I'll start with a case where is a, you know, a real case that I was involved in that, you know, anchoring was the main issue with the case. And instead of me just saying you're anchoring on X, Y, or Z, you know, I was in the sort of luckily in the midst of researching this, I came across these topics and actually used it in that situation with the residents, and I thought it was actually pretty helpful. So I'll set the stage. We're in the ICU. It's a wonderful day. It's very sunny. You get a call from the floor about a patient. So the patient is a 50-year-old male with a very complex past medical history, but it includes, but is not limited to, adrenal insufficiency from chronic steroid use for sort of unknown reasons. I know that's weird, but just sort of take it for what it is. Type 2 diabetes, reduced ejection heart failure, had a previous LV thrombus, was on Coumadin, paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, CKD stage 3, had a Roux-en-Y bypass in 2018. Since then, has had chronic sort of pancytopenia that has been worked up extensively with no sort of organic cause found, thought to be due to overall nutritional deficiency because lost a lot of weight, obviously, since the Roux-en-Y bypass. Had Wernicke's encephalopathy at one point, and sort of had been coming in and out of the ER for the past few months. Similar story, hypoglycemic, hypotensive, altered mental status. So again, comes to the emergency department, hypoglycemic, altered mental status, hypotensive, was placed on a D10 drip in the emergency department, bear hugger, sort of initial workup sent off, which was, I won't say benign, but nothing different than previous workup, like still pancytopenic, still hypoglycemic, creatinine still hanging around the same sort of level that it had been before. Family called EMS because it was altered, hasn't really been taking a lot of nutrition in, and so he comes back to the hospital. In the emergency department, because of, you know, the history of chronic steroid use and hypoglycemia, hypotension, hypothermia, was given steroids. In the ED, had initial workup sent off. Similar labs from before, but received steroids in the setting of, as I mentioned, hypoglycemic, hypothermic, hypotensive, placed on bear hugger. Had been in the hospital for about 1 to 2 days. Endocrine saw the patient, who actually did both an AM cortisol and a cosentropin test. Bochwith demonstrated that the patient did not have adrenal insufficiency, so had subsequently taken off of steroids because had sort of been on them, off them, but for unclear reasons. So they decided to sort of test the patient for AI while the patient was in the hospital and was negative. So it was taken off. So that was hospital day two. So hospital day three, still in the hospital, sort of, you know, on and off D5 drip. They're trying to sort of encourage oral nutrition. Noted to have abdominal pain, diarrhea, some nausea. The team taking care of the patient saw the patient on the floor, decided that it was, you know, nothing, just thought it might have been from sort of not any specific complaint or any specific reason, excuse me. Obtained lab studies. The exam was sort of benign, maybe some abdominal pain on palpation, but really couldn't get a clear sense of it. So gave some symptomatic treatment, patient got better. Overnight from day 3 to day 4, early in the morning, the next morning, the patient was noted to be quite hypotensive. So like something like 78 over 47 with a MAP of 58, which had been different than the previous MAP because after being admitted to the hospital day 1, while they were lower in like the low 60s, they had trended up. So maybe into the 70s. So this MAP of 58 was much different than it had been. So retook the blood pressure, MAP still low, and was also found to be hypoglycemic again. So received D50 push. In that time frame, the ICU was consulted, obviously, for hypotension. So the team went to see the patient and then comes back to tell me about the patient's, you know, history, physical and such. So, you know, even before we get into the physical, it's already, oh, it's probably just the patient's adrenal insufficiency. And I said, well, I thought, you know, endocrine said that the patient did have adrenal insufficiency. They had a cosentropin test. They're like, yeah, well, I mean, he's back hypotensive, hypoglycemic, and like altered. So it's probably just adrenal insufficiency. I said, again, endocrine said it. I mean, the cosentropin test is pretty good. That's like sort of how you diagnose it. So if it doesn't show it on the cosentropin test that was done yesterday, I'm a little confused about how, you know, we can sort of be back to adrenal insufficiency. So, you know, re-got all the lab works, which, to be honest, weren't any different than sort of the initial labs. A few things were different that will sort of elucidate down the line, but nothing was sort of screaming at you that anything was different in the biochemical studies, at least. Other vital signs were, I want to say normal. I don't want to say normal, but I'll say not sort of alarming. The heart rate was less than 90, so sort of a normal heart rate. Was not hypothermic again, and you know, the blood pressure was low, as I mentioned, which was a change. So brought the patient down to the ICU, obviously, because of the hypotension. So, you know, talked to the floor team, my ICU team, a bunch of other people, and we're sort of like really anchoring on this adrenal insufficiency. To which I said, you guys are anchoring on adrenal insufficiency. We have to come up with a different plan. So this is where, you know, sort of like the other processes for combating cognitive biases come in. So businesses have identified that cognitive bias, specifically overconfidence, is a problem with teams, especially with dynamic teams, either setting up new businesses or new plans. So one of the ways we can combat overconfidence is the idea of what we call pre-mortem. And I don't know if you guys have heard of pre-mortem before. So you heard of post-mortem, right? So post-mortem, like an autopsy, but not so much in the sense of like a medical, but in if you have a business that fails, you can sort of do a post-mortem and sort of identify what were the lesions that caused this business to fail. So taking that thought, you do a pre-mortem, which, as the name might mention, you being the leader, so me as the attending or you guys as sort of the leads in the unit, you know, you say to the team, so you put it in a safe space, meaning you say, this, whatever our plan is, failed. You just give them that expectation. Whatever we're going to do, it's going to fail. So why does it fail? And when you create that environment that you already set up the expectation that your plan is going to fail, then you can start working on why it's going to fail. When you do a pre-mortem, you want to empower the whole team to give their ideas. So the maker of the pre-mortem, which is Gary Klein, he sort of identifies how to do this. And obviously in the business world, it's more of like it's a process where you sit down around the table and you give everyone sheets of paper and everyone sort of writes down, you know, one reason why the business is going to fail and then one fix that they potentially have. So you're sort of leveraging the experience and the thoughts of the whole team in a safe space, because as you guys probably know, and I think it's reasonable to say, when you're in, especially in the medical environment, let's say a team with attendings, residents, maybe fellows, nurses, you know, some of the team members are probably afraid to speak up, not for the least of which that, you know, people don't really feel, might not feel empowered to speak up, especially if they're going against what the prevailing plan is, because it sort of feels like we're naysayers. So when you give them the sort of like empower them by saying that the plan is going, you know, the plan has failed. So we're sort of thinking 3 months down the road, or for a patient, let's say, you know, in a week or something, we come back and we say, listen, obviously you don't say this in front of the patient or the family or whatever, sort of, you know, around somewhere else. You say, so for this situation, I said to them, listen, imagine that we're wrong and the patient dies. What would you change differently right now? Like, how would we sort of change our approach? And it's actually interesting what you see happen, because, you know, you might think that this is just like doing a differential diagnosis, but it takes on a little bit different of a character, because when you set up the expectation that whatever plan you have is going to fail, it creates this sort of, I think for medical personnel at least, it creates like a sense of urgency to think of other reasons why, you know, the plan might have failed, because it's going to cost someone their life. So when I did that, you'd be sort of surprised like what kind of answers I got that were sort of like really far reaching. Obviously, me being me and like sort of I go for the low hanging fruit, I'm like, you know, this is, you know, what, is she septic? Like, is she infected? So we're, you know, go back and forth. Well, the white count's not that high and she didn't have a fever and she's not really hypothermic and that kind of stuff. And, you know, my thought was, you know, that's the most important thing to identify, because if this is sepsis and she is hypotensive or he is hypotensive, you know, the longer we delay treatment, i.e. antibiotics and source control if we need it, you know, the worse the outcome is going to be. And I think that's sort of borne out in the studies and the reason we give antibiotics early and, you know, all of that sort of jazz, which we can talk about in a different time. So, you know, when you set up a sort of like a postmortem to guard against, or sort of, excuse me, a premortem to guard against cognitive bias, it creates this space for everyone involved in the team to think of different reasons why the plan is going to fail. And when you do that and give that expectation, it allows everyone to feel empowered to speak up. When I am rounding, at least sometimes, you know, I want that, you know, I want, because we're attendings are humans too. I don't know if you guys knew that, but we're humans too. So there are things happening in my life and maybe the kids are sick, my wife's sick, I have other things going on in my personal life. And, you know, sometimes it's hard for me to sort of like come up with these brilliant ideas. I know it just seems like I'm a, you know, a brilliant idea generator, but sometimes it's hard to sort of like get that from, you know, the ground up. So I love when residents, interns, nurses, whoever it is, APPs, if I'm working with the other teams, they come up with, you know, ideas and just sort of bounce them off. But a lot of people, I think, don't feel empowered because they're intimidated by the situation, and because of that intimidation, they don't speak up. But what they have to offer might actually be really important. So how do you sort of like break that barrier of the intimidation factor, especially for, you know, newer learners?
What I find most powerful, I think, is that it, like you said, in theory, we all are generating diagnostic differentials that are, you know, more than one thing. But in practice, I think as people, we all have this kind of tendency to, it's like backing your favorite sports team. You know, you don't really believe in multiple things. You believe in one thing. And all the more so if you get starting to get attached to a diagnosis, which, you know, as we're talking about, anchoring is so common. It might be that it's the most elegant diagnosis. You know, if someone is fulfilling a triad or something like that. If this was a question stem, you would absolutely know what it is. It might be, you know, that's what the newer clinician would go with. An experienced person, I think, tends to anchor on the most common things because that's what they're familiar with. And they believe the classic stuff never happens, which is obviously an error in the opposite direction. But whatever it is, you're kind of stick with one thing. And then to ask people, you know, but of course it could be multiple things, and they'll say, oh yeah, of course, but they don't really believe it. They really believe it's the thing that they think it is. And just like deep down, they're like, it is that. So then if they say, oh yeah, well, it could be other stuff. It's not an honest differential. They just say, well, yeah, it could also be a PE or it could be hemorrhage, but it's adrenal insufficiency. So
you feel like you have to list multiple things so you don't just look dumb. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They don't think those. Yeah. But if you say, okay, sure. It's adrenal insufficiency. It is. You're letting the the part of them that backs the Broncos like relax and say, okay, yeah, you're right. Let's just pretend. let's pretend it's not that. Of course, that's crazy. That's great. But let's just imagine in a world where that's not the case. What else could it be? And then they can say, well, if that were true, it's probably this. And then they could say, well, that's actually not such a bad possibility.
Mm-hmm. I think that, and that's like backing your favorite sports team is probably, unfortunately, that's like a really good way to put it, because you can almost see when you deliver that, it's like feedback, you know, Brandon thinks it's adrenal insufficiency or PE. And I say, I don't, you know, you can't, if I say, I don't think that's what it is. It's like, you can see this letdown in like their eyes, like, oh man, like Nick doesn't think it's AI, like, you know, what I do wrong type deal. And, you know, it's not even like for me as a critical care doc, it's not exactly like getting up front, at least, you know, it's not getting it right. It's just getting it to not be lethal. So if it isn't or is AI, like that's, I have no horse in the game. Like that's fine if it's AI or PE or whatever it is. I just have to make sure that I am taking care of all the things that can possibly be lethal to the patient. Right?
Yeah, like minimizing that, risk. If we start actually like putting chips down and say, I mean, I hate to say I've done this. It's like, hey, you know, what do you think? Let's like literally, like not literally, put money in or whatever. And that kind of gets people to, you know, commit to things, which is probably a healthy learning tool. But it's not a good cognitive way to go about it, right? Because then you start thinking it only can be one thing and you close your mind to any other possibility.
You know, and putting your chips down is another good way of putting it, because when you sort of like, you know, where the rubber meets the road and you like sort of force someone to, you know, like, unfortunately you said PE, so this always goes on like a different path. Because whenever you say PE, PE is like, you know, is like Beetlejuice. So once you say it, like you have to address the elephant in the room. But when you sort of like force a person to like double down, do you think it's PE? Because if you do, then we have to get a contrasted scan and their creatinine clearance is, you know, 31. And everyone's sort of worried about that number, you'd be surprised how many people sort of back off it. You know, like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe it is sepsis, or maybe it is AI, or maybe it's just heart failure or something. And I'm like, no, nothing, like nothing changed, right? Like nothing changed. If you think it's that, like now we got to, you know, you have to do it. And
this idea of, well, I can't get the contrasted scan because their kidneys or whatever. And I always tell students, you know, if you think they need the scan, they need the scan. And if they don't need the scan, they don't need the scan, right? We shouldn't be saying, well, their kidneys are okay, so we should just give them a load of contrast and see what happens, right? That's not a good way to practice medicine. If they need the scan, they need the scan, and we'll just deal with the fallout. And yeah, like you said, it's funny how when you put it to them, you know, where your back's against the wall, their kidneys are messed up, how many people will back off and go, well, maybe they don't need it, right?
Like, well, I mean, maybe the real answer is to not use this language of, do we think it's this? Or, I mean, because then we're getting into like beliefs again, and you know, like what your personal beliefs. Well, I believe this is PE. Well, I don't believe this is PE. Maybe it doesn't matter what any of us believe. I mean, what you're asking, what are you asking? Do they think it's more than 50% likely that it's this diagnosis? Or, I mean, what's the real question here? The question is, what should we do, right? Which is a matter of, you know, test and treatment threshold. So really what you're saying is, does the benefit of, let's say, getting a scan exceed the risks or harms? And if you think that it does, then you should. And does that mean you thought there was PE? I don't know. I mean, what it means, you thought there was a possibility, of course. Maybe you only thought there was a 10% possibility, but that's more than, you know, the harms of the thing. And then if it comes back negative, it's not like, oh, we were wrong. You know, what were you wrong about? Your assessment of the risk? No. You just, right. you ruled that out, right. And now, you know.
Just because it was a negative PE scan, I feel like some people are dejected from that in a way. Like, oh, it was negative. We were wrong, as you mentioned, Brandon. But it's not, you know, it's not a point of like being wrong or right. It's sort of like working through your differential.
Right.
What's the most important? What's going to kill the patient right now?
Well, and you know who's really good at this? I feel like emergency medicine. Sometimes I'll sit upstairs and be like, oh, it seems like they don't even care what the patient has sometimes down there. But that's not quite right. I mean, what they are really good at is thinking in terms of risks the way we're talking about. And at the end of the day, they're not usually able to know exactly what's wrong with the patient. But they can make sure it's not one of the handful of things that they have to treat right now. And they've mitigated that risk. And we're in a much better setting to maybe nail down something very specific. But we're never going to catch one of them being like, I think it's this, I'm like, my ego is now hung on this diagnosis or something. They're like, don't care. I got more patients to see. It's not a PE. Move along.
For the undifferentiated patient, I mean, it's like an undifferentiated shortness of breath. When I look in the chart and I see that they got LASIK, steroids, and antibiotics, I think that like the medicine world probably sort of thumbs our nose at that in some way, but you don't know. I mean, you don't know. And the rapid response, like that's where I feel that everyone who takes care of patients clinically, so whether it's APPs, residents, interns, attendings, you should do a rapid response, like have some time on a rapid response team, because that lets you figure out how, like very quickly, how difficult it is to figure out what is wrong with sort of an undifferentiated shortness of breath, an undifferentiated chest pain, undifferentiated abdominal pain, undifferentiated hypotension. So like having those sort of neurons stretch in that time, stretching that system one thinking, and that like by doing that, I think is something that everyone should do because it really makes you diagnostically humble.
It's like being back in the ED, yeah. And it's more important at that phase of care to not be wrong than to be right.
But getting back to the heuristic model, you know, for me, like rapid response wise, when I was a resident, I would always forget to ask for a sugar. You know, how embarrassing is that? I would always forget to ask for like, what was the sugar? And a lot of times it's like patients altered and like you get a sugar and sugar is like 30 and then you get them D50 and they wake up. So I would forget to get a sugar all the time or ask for a sugar. So eventually I actually wrote it on my ID badge, like rapid response and just like get sugar. So I would just like look at it and say, what's the sugar? And then the nurse would say, the AccuCheck's 419 or like 500 or something, you know? And I would like, so I sort of built that into my mental model of how to sort of approach a rapid undifferentiated patient that's sort of acute. And that's, you know, that's sort of maybe the epitome of a system one thinking sort of heuristic, right? So we have a lot of data coming at us. We need to fit it into this model or this framework. And we just sort of identify the framework in our mind. And maybe after, you know, 100 patients, we see a similar presentation, we go down that route. The bias issues come into play when we are sort of too hooked to that for some reason or another, whether it's confirmation bias or anchoring or sunken cost or whatever it is. But for me, just identifying that bias wasn't enough because it doesn't sort of prevent you from making that mistake in the future and it doesn't help you in that time frame. Like, how do I sort of escape that bias thought? So, you know, the pre-mortem I thought was a great way to do that. And it's like how, you know, Gary Klein and other behavioral psychologists teach teams to identify possible problems with their plan and then, you know, either make contingencies around that or, you know, identify other things, which brings me to the second sort of topic of how to combat bias, which is sort of this white swan versus black swan theory. I don't know if you guys heard of this before. I never heard of it. I thought it was pretty interesting. So like in business, it's all about sort of risk identification, I think. I'm not a businessman, but I hear that's a pretty big topic, is like identifying risk. So you have like known risks and unknown risks. Known risks are what is sort of broadly characterized as white swans. So these are like known issues with a business plan that could cause it to fail. There are also black swans, which are unknown risks. They're unexpected outcomes, but they have typical characteristics. In hindsight, when you look at why the plan failed, you know, sort of after it does, the black swan appears obvious. Ah, the patient died. Oh, you know what? I guess it wasn't AI. It was septic shock. It was PE. Of course, like she's been in, you know, he's been in bed for days. Or of course, you know, as in this case, when we got labs again, the white count was about the same, which was lower. It was like 6. But there was a very, very high bandemia, like 25%. So, you know, though you look back and you're like, ah, I mean, it was obvious, right? Like it was X or it was Y. We didn't identify that. So the pre-mortem analysis sort of helps you identify possible black swans later, which, you know, takes you out of sort of that cognitive bias thought process that don't forget, we sort of need that to deal with our world because it's complex and we are complex emotional animals that are just trying to sort of make it through and make the best decisions we can. But because there's so much input, we have to, you know, whittle down like what's important. And our brain does that by creating this heuristic model, and then bias comes as a result of it. So these things are necessary, I think, in some ways. But for us being medical professionals, obviously, especially with like the, so it's different, right? For like, let's say a trauma surgeon, you know, someone gets hit by a car and their leg is broke. There's not really like a heuristic model you need. You know, you get an x-ray, the leg is broke, we need to go to the OR. It's like kind of simple. But for medical, certainly medical, like internal medicine, so like the medicine problems, heart failure, PE, pneumonia, all these things, since there's so many different ways things can present and the data can be so different, we need to cast a wide net. We talk about this by doing like a broad differential, but as I think we've sort of highlighted, and for me too, I'm not immune to it. Like that is probably my biggest problem, is that I look at a chart and then, you know, do a physical exam, talk to the patient. I come up with a diagnosis and I am pretty like entrenched in that diagnosis, and I will fight tooth and nail to sort of make it be proven. And how do you not do that? Because that's probably like the actual definition of anchoring, right? So, you know, doing these things, so like pre-mortem analysis, identifying what in black swans, helps you identify potential issues and where the cognitive bias is leading you astray.
Yeah, one of the things that I often ponder on is, we've kind of all internalized this idea of system one and system two thinking, and it's easy to think that, you know, system two kind of more thoughtful, deliberative, systematic reasoning is just better, but that's not right. You know, you can't live your life that way. You know, even if that's your goal, we can't do most of our medicine that way. It is going to be knee-jerk heuristic stuff. But the question then is, when do you use which? And I think what you're saying is exactly right. We should try to design structures and safeguards into what we do, which helps prevent it from being a problem in the first place, you know, to ward off some of the known risks of system one thinking. But sometimes I think it is helpful to be able to consciously mode switch and say, we're thinking in a particular model, which is, I think, not useful right now. And that's not always possible. I mean, it's fighting some of your own, you know, natural tendencies. But sometimes you can, and especially for thinking that is not a single flash. You know, if you're reasoning through something, a situation or a problem, and it's you're giving it a little bit of a thought process, then there may be time for you or for your team to say, you know, hang on, I think we're doing this the wrong way. And it could be either way. You could be using too much kind of, you know, knee-jerk heuristics when you really need to be more thoughtful about it. Or you could be being too thoughtful when you need to be more knee-jerk. And that's something that might happen in like an emergency scene. Someone's starting to contemplate the hyponatremia when you need to just manage the airway or something.
I think that's a lot of the gripes against maybe internal medicine docs in general. Like, you know, there's like memes and stuff where the patient's crashing and the internal medicine doc is like writing the note about the hyponatremia. And, you know, and you're right. I mean, you need both system one in some situations, system two in other situations, which is why I think the rapid response is like a unique sort of, you know, splitting it down the middle, because you need to be system one in a way, which is figure, you know, take the patient out of harm, whatever that is. But then system two, like now we have to figure out why. And it's sort of hard to go back in between both, right? Like it's a lot of like mental juggling.
You can look at a situation and say, like at least dispassionately, if you're able to say this, you could say, this is clearly because of the time course, the acuity, you know, the threats to life, and particularly the risks, I think. This is like this calls for system one, because it doesn't matter what they have. What matters is the things we're talking about, you know, mitigating risk and heading off all the immediate perils, and then there's time for other things. And then there's other situations where it's not like that. Maybe the time course you're dealing with is a little bit longer. Maybe you've already clearly been wrong using your immediate heuristics. Maybe this is the patient who's been around for a little while. You've tested for this. You've treated for that. They're not getting better, that kind of thing. And then you could say, we need to stop just doing the first thing that comes to mind and think through this because we've sort of failed the other model here.
I can think of so many situations like that too. You know, the patient's been in the hospital for a month. Like every attending has sort of had a crack at them about, you know, X, Y, or Z. And we just come up with nothing. And then like time passes and they either sort of like get worse or get better. And, you know, we have to, like you mentioned, we have to sort of stop just doing like the knee jerk procal is five, they're coughing. It's gotta be a pneumonia type deal. You know, like sort of like take a deeper dive into the chart maybe.
Yeah. Cause the mere fact that they've been around for 3 weeks doesn't mean that anyone has spent more than 5 seconds right. on the case. You know, even new team comes in, new consult, new person, new day. They're still gonna might be like, oh, this looks like it could be that, you know, let's do that thing. But, you know, has anyone actually really thought through it the way you would, you know, do it in school? And you know, that's what we all learn to do in school, right? This like thoughtful system to approaches. And then it's like, we all forget it once you get into practice, but.
There's a lot of different sort of outlets for finding content on cognitive bias, whether it's like, you know, different websites or like podcasts online or reading about it, reading the book Thinking Fast and Slow, which is an interesting book, don't get me wrong. But what I implore the listeners is, you know, instead of just sort of identifying that we, you know, we have compassion fade or whatever it is, you know, how do we guard against that? Because that's, you know, in these situations, like that's probably the most important thing is, while we know that these are like necessary evils, heuristics is a necessary evil, especially in clinical medicine, there are times where it's deleterious, especially to the patient that's maybe undifferentiated and we need to sort of think more deeply. And just doing a like a broad different like differential diagnosis because, you know, you type into ChatGPT hypernatremia, altered mental status, hypoglycemia, and like spits back, you know, 25 different diagnoses. Like that's sort of not enough, you know, and it's not really helpful because it leads down a lot of rabbit holes, I think. So while I love a good differential diagnosis, sometimes I think it's a little bit of an exercise of futility because it doesn't get you any closer to the answer. And so I feel like the IM world is going to like sort of come for me, and that's okay. But I, you know, like 47 differentials doesn't like help us get, you know, I just need the right answer. I don't need, you know, a lot of answers. You know what I mean?
So, well, yeah. And like I said, I feel like this is where emergency medicine has the most tools because they have put a lot of thought and effort into honing these tools for thinking, which is it's almost totally separate from that diagnostic approach to, you know, quote, finding the answer, but is in its own way quite well developed. They have their own tools, their own research, their own ways of thinking. And it's so useful for that particular sort of situation. And, you know, we all should have, it's, you know, what is critical care, but the coming together of the thoughtful hyponatremia patient and the, you know, the crashing airway or whatever. You need to be able to do both. But to kind of just chalk up one as not real thinking or not real medicine or something doesn't make any sense. And we could all probably learn something from those guys. And when you get the call from the ED and they say some stuff and you're like, well, like what's going on? And they kind of are not even talking about that. They're talking about what's not going on, you know, to be able to realize that that is exactly the right way of thinking for that moment in time and kind of appreciate that.
Not to keep you in suspense, but maybe what, you know, what the patient that I described, you know, what was it? And, you know, we did the pre-mortem actually. I thought it was pretty interesting. And I don't remember all the ideas that we got, but, you know, team members that I had that maybe were sort of more sheepish in the beginning of the week, because this was like sort of later in my week in service, you know, were a lot more passionate about like sort of talking about what they thought. And I think, you know, giving that safety of like just allowing what the plan is to fail and, you know, as the leader saying that it's failed and we need to think of why, I think that's really important because, you know, in a different situation, let's say, you know, you're with an attending, you're with like APPs or residents or interns or something, and you just have it, you know, you're sort of like in the big group thought and everyone's sort of pontificating about what they think, or the resident says, you know, I think it's this, and the fellow says, I think it's that. You know, it's like very intimidating for an intern to sort of speak up and say, well, I think it could be this, right? So when you give sort of that like emotional and psychological safety of like this plan has failed, we need to think of why, especially because a patient's life is on the line, you'd be surprised at the answers that you get. But anyway, it was like a very lively discussion. And so we had like a broad differential, but we had some specific goals we needed to do, which was we needed to sort of rescue this patient because they were hypotensive and like altered and then was sort of off to the races. Very sick. But, you know, for me, I said hypotension, altered mental status. You know, I looked at the bandemia and I'm like, oh boy, this is not, you know, if this is legit, like this is bad, right? Because like bandemia is sort of associated with, I think, worse outcomes than sepsis. So I'm like, we need, you know, sepsis needs to be number one. It might not be right, but it needs to be number one because it's the most lethal. So, you know, antibiotics, got a scan. So before this, we can get the patient to the scan, blood cultures already come back, you know, 4 out of 4 mixed organisms. So GPCs and GNRs and all kinds of stuff. Get the patient to the scanner, scan comes back, perforated gallbladder. That, you know, in hindsight, maybe, you know, is this like sort of a black swan? Like, you know, in hindsight, it's obvious, right? Like LFTs, while we're, you know, not normal, but we're like maybe a little bit more deranged, but had that abdominal pain that I talked about before, was had nausea, had some diarrhea, had some sort of random stuff that we chalked up to just being like symptomatic for some reason that, you know, wasn't significant enough for like maybe a CAT scan, but maybe a little bit more significant than just like sort of passing by for a, you know, a quick abdominal exam. Like, oh, there's a little pain, but it's not really that bad. But, you know, it was sort of a perfect, and not that I felt, and unfortunately, they worked their way onto so much pressure that we just restarted steroids and sort of the sepsis realm. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to sort of stand on that to like, you know, of course it wasn't adrenal insufficiency, but, you know, I like feeling vindicated in a way that, you know, we did this exercise and we identified that we could have been wrong. We were in fact wrong. And, but we still mitigated the risk by doing this exercise that allowed us to think outside the box and assume that our initial plan had failed. Not that I thought it was that to begin with, but, you know, part of being the leader is not so much like, you know, imposing that you're right on everyone. It's just like helping everyone guide themselves to sort of the right answer by sort of assimilating the data. That I think that's the most important thing that we can do as like leaders of the team, or if you're sort of instructing students or, you know, people that are like residents, interns, or other folks. Pre-mortem, very interesting on, there's a couple of YouTube videos that you can watch about it and how it's done and sort of like how the business world does it, which is a little bit more formal. And then, you know, identifying white and black swans. And then also the shadow boxing technique, which is a little bit different, not like what we're talking about, but sort of fits into this like pattern recognition. How do experts identify situations? And it's not by, you know, point by point recognition. It's by identifying a pattern that you store in your mind based off of patterns that you've seen before, you know? So that's how you sort of make decisions, which is hard, I think, when, you know, something doesn't sort of fit the pattern that you've seen before, and you're sort of trying to like make it fit, like sort of, you know, round peg square hole, and it sort of like doesn't fit. Sometimes I like to take a step back, me personally, and think to myself, like, why isn't this like fitting, you know, so neatly as it should? Is it something else? Am I missing something? So, and that's hard to do a lot of times, especially when you're in sort of a high stakes environment like the ICU or the emergency department or, you know, code blue or rapid response.
Well, I think too, when you have that pattern, the trick is to not fall into the easy thing of false pattern recognition. You know, especially if you have that pattern established, right, because of some, for lack of a better word, trauma, right? So a kind of an extreme example, you know, when I was a fairly new nurse, I had a patient who had come in from a nursing home for shortness of breath, altered mental status, went to this CAT scanner for CT. And she just the whole time kept complaining that she was constipated and she wanted to be disimpacted and all this stuff, and having this horrible abdominal pain related to this constipation. And, you know, coming out of the scanner, she's not hollering anymore. We're all getting a little worried because now she's not screaming. And we got up to the ICU, she codes, and she died. And, you know, during the code, radiology calls up and says massive saddle PE. And, you know, in fact, later when we Ooh. Looked further, she had mesenteric ischemia from, you know, clots in the SMA. And that's why she was having this abdominal pain. So for years, every time I had someone who complained of this just out of proportion abdominal pain and constipation, I got panicked about mesenteric ischemia. I don't think I've seen mesenteric ischemia since, but it's on the top of my list every time it happens, right? Because of the trauma associated with that.
Look at that.
That case. Yep. So I think it's helpful to see that pattern recognition, but you got to be careful not to jump to the conclusion that it's some weird zebra because you saw a zebra once.
Well, and maybe the lesson from a case like that is not that every patient has a ischemic gut. It's to, you know, attend to persistent unexplained complaints from patients that you haven't diagnosed or something like that. Because, you know, it's a really good question, I think, to ask when something like that happens. What should I learn from this? Because it is easy to learn the wrong thing. Like you said, like to fixate on the one terrible outcome you had that caused a lawsuit or something like that. I mean, that case deserves no more weight in your decision-making than any other, but it probably will. So that, you know, the role of the actual postmortem, like we're kind of talking about pre-mortems, maybe is to say, you know, what can we learn from this case that we can do better for next time? But trying to make that the right thing. And sometimes the answer is nothing. We did everything perfectly. And we just got unlucky.
Right.
But in
exactly.
To really ask, in what way can we alter our thinking that optimizes our chances of doing better next time, which may have nothing to do with getting the answer right or something like that. It's like the things we're talking about, kind of a good approach to risk-taking and taking the right lesson from something. Because I think we all like to assume that experience teaches us everything we need to know about medicine. But in fact, the volume of what we see is probably not high enough for that, for almost everything.
Right.
And especially for somewhat unlikely things. I mean, if you say you have experience with something, what does it mean? You've seen it three or four times? If someone showed you a data with that many patients, you would right. completely write that off. It's mostly chance and luck. So to learn anything, we have to be much more thoughtful about, you know, what did this actually teach me that's not just a product of this particular case, but is generalizable?
Yeah, and I think in that case, the easy take home right. from that, which is the wrong one, right, is to assume, to always put mesenteric ischemia in your differential for unexplained abdominal pain. But the right take home, and what I have done ever since, is to not write off complaints, right? Because everybody's like, oh, this is an old lady who's from the nursing home. Every old person thinks they're constipated, you know, and they just sort of blow it off.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's the thing that I did learn from that I still do to this day is don't write off complaints just because it seems like crap, right? A constipation joke, but
I don't know if this is just because like I'm older or like more cantankerous, but I asked the patient, like, why are you here? Like, why are you here right now? You know, because we hear all these things like, oh, I got HFrEF and da da da. I'm today, like, why did you come to the hospital today? Like, why did you come? And you'd be surprised what people say, like, oh, my back's been hurting for 2 weeks and like, and it leads you down this whole different path, you know? And I understand that like patients sort of, you know, it could be a very long soliloquy about, you know, their life. And you sort of like, you need to be really like goal oriented when you ask questions. But sometimes I like to take a step back and just like really big picture, like, why are you here? You know? And it takes me down different paths that I didn't think that I would be. And it's helped me in a couple of different situations, like really sort of break the mold of what we were doing. Cause it like, you know, I figured out like, wow, like it, you know, it isn't like, yes, he's here cause he has like chest pain, but in fact he has epigastric pain, which started to be like last week. Cause he took all of his ibuprofen that he got from his PCP who stopped his chronic opiate. Cause we said that opiates are bad for back pain. And now he has a bleeding ulcer. You know what I mean? So it like, yeah, I can't agree with you enough that not writing off complaints just because someone's old or demented or like lethargic or delirious or whatever it is like...
Well, yeah, any story someone's telling or what they're focusing on could be wrong or not helpful, but at least giving the patient the chance to shape their story before you start shaping it based on whatever happens to interest you in the chart or something is probably a good way to start. But, all right, guys, anything else we should say about this?
Cognitive biases are cool and like that thought process and the... You know, behavioral psychology is like a cool topic and very much important to medicine. And, you know, knowing the cognitive biases is, I guess, important. I'm not sure how important like riddling them off is, like what authority bias is and what, you know, blind spot bias is and that kind of stuff. But, you know, how do we safeguard ourselves against bias where it could be deleterious in situations? And hopefully, you know, either the shadow box technique or premortem or identifying white swans and black swans can be something you take back to your teams and actually like do these things. I mean, it's not like a theoretical exercise. This is an actual thing that you can do at the bedside when you have a case that the patient's, you know, sort of stable in air quotes, however you sort of define that, and you're not sure what's happening, but you want to safeguard yourself against bias. Instead of just identifying like Brandon, that was anchoring. Don't anchor again. And Brandon's like, all right, yeah, definitely. I won't anchor again, sir. And then, you know, then it's like, then what do you do from there? Like, how do you not anchor? You know? So I think this was, these techniques were like, actually gives you the tools to not be biased.
Well, thanks for coming back. It's been a great, great topic. I'm glad we were able to touch on this. I think we have not really said anything about cognitive biases in the past, and it's such an important topic that's probably been, we've been a little bit remiss. So appreciate you joining us. We'll remind everyone else, if you have not checked out the Intensive Care Academy, go check it out, icu101.com. We've got video lessons on all kinds of critical care topics, ranging from an orientation program for the new APPs to we're rolling out a MICU-based course right now, and Brian's going to drop a POCUS course pretty soon as well. Check it out if you haven't. And otherwise, we will see you guys next time.